I'd like to make one request before we begin. It's one of our rituals. Everyone, please move forward, because what happens is people come late, and then when they come in, it disturbs. In the front, move forward, and then behind that, move forward, and everybody move forward. Thank you. Ladies, too, forward. Please come forward. Mataji with the child is going to stay in the back because he needs to sometimes take a walk. Come forward, please. Thank you. You'll see why. People will come at the end and... Thanks. Thank you very much. Okay. So the topic that I've chosen to speak on while visiting with you in Hyderabad is Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 3. It has a very nice title also. Pure Devotional Service, Change of Heart. Nice topic. At the turn of the new year, this year, I decided two things. Back to basics. For my own personal internal cultivation of Krishna consciousness, and also presentation of Krishna consciousness, because there are essences of Krishna consciousness that we very easily can pass over, and trying to advance further without capturing and entering deeply into the essences of Krishna consciousness, you don't go very far. And so I decided this year, I'll see if I can manage to complete, in the course of my travels, discussion on the entire second canto, Srimad Bhagavatam. Krishna willing, that maybe will happen. And I've completed two chapters so far. And just a little underscore of back to basics. Shortly before coming here, I took part in our GBC meetings in Mayapur, and one whole session, well, like an hour plus, hour and half, was dedicated to one of our GBC members speaking on the topic of what to think about when chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Where should the mind be reposed when you're chanting Hare Krishna Maha Mantra? That's pretty basic, right? Really basic. A, B, C. So the presentation was called Nectar of Devotion 101 at a GBC meeting. Back to basics. Somehow or another, while in Mayapur, the subject that was being covered in the morning Srimad Bhagavatam class was Canto 2, Srimad Bhagavatam, Chapter 2. And it just so happened that it was the very verse that I had finished speaking on when I was last in America that I was called upon to speak on in Mayapur. So I've sent that out. Some devotees received it. There are others that would like just a kind of an overview of the second canto, the first couple chapters of the second canto. I'll do a little bit of that with you right now, but it's in a written form and you might appreciate receiving. If you want to receive it, did you receive it? So give your name with somebody here and we'll see if you get a copy. A devotee and his wife that transcribe all the lectures and then send them out, put them up on the somewhere. So he sent it to me. I'm not going to do a whole review of what gets us into chapter 3, but I'll make a couple of comments that these two cantos, Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1 and Canto 2, they're compared in the Padma Purana to the lotus feet of the literary incarnation of the Supreme Lord. And so when we're hearing, meditating upon, absorbing our consciousness in this message, we're absorbing our consciousness in the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. And what does that mean, to achieve shelter at the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord? Minimally, it means purity, and it means submission and humility. Humble service rendered at the feet of the Supreme Lord. So to achieve that purity and that humility and submission, these first two cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam are essential. The whole of the first canto, Prabhupada said when he came to deliver the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, he said that everything you need to know to go back to Godhead is right here. If you can learn the message of the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, you're equipped to go back home, back to Godhead. In this Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 1, the summary of the whole, all the topics of the Bhagavatam are presented in essence form, and then further expanded in later cantos. Many subjects are discussed, but one that we're going to focus on is towards the latter portion of the first canto, the birth of Maharaj Parikshit, preceded by the protection of Maharaj Parikshit when he was within the womb of his mother, by Krishna himself. Even before Maharaj Parikshit did anything, he was dear to Krishna. Then what to speak of all the qualities and devotional service and very heroic deeds that he performed. He was very, very dear to Krishna. He was attached like anything to Krishna, and Krishna was attached like anything to him. So, rather than expanding on that understanding, the glories of Maharaj Parikshit as the qualified hearer of the message of Srimad Bhagavatam is very clear. The circumstance of his making an offense to a sage in meditation is then described in chapter 18. Could you get the shoulder bag from my room? And his being cursed by the son of that sage to die in 7 days, his willing acceptance of that curse, his giving up his kingdom and taking shelter of the banks of the river Ganges, calling upon all the sages of the whole planet to come and guide him in how to prepare himself to meet death, is the 18th chapter, and there's 19 chapters in Canto 1. Shukadev Goswami arrives on the scene. And the glories of Shukadev Goswami are described. And the king receives him in a fitting way for an elevated person that Shukadev Goswami is. Not only the king receives him, but all the sages stand, as is the culture, where there's still some culture remaining in the world. When a respectable person enters into the assembly of others, they all rise. Little hint is, there's not much culture to be found in America. So if you go to America and don't find that, that's because it's America. But there is some vestige of that in the court system. Everyone's seated, and when the judge comes into the court, the order of the clerk is, everyone rise, out of respect, because he's the judge. Everyone else there is at his, whatever he decides. So when Shukadeva Goswami entered into the assembly of very, very senior sages, they all respected him, and he was just a 16-year-old boy. But immediately, and they had never met him before, but just to be in his presence, they could understand how elevated was his position. And so they all stood in respect. Maharaj Parikshit submitted himself at the feet, just like this nice picture, at the feet of Shukadeva Goswami, and submitted two questions. Those two questions were, first, he was concerned about the welfare of his citizens or people in general, because he's a king. And what is the thought of a protector of those who are dependents? It's to the welfare of the dependents. First thought. He's about to die in 7 days, and he's thinking about those who are dependent upon him. So what is it that is the all-around good, that which everyone in general should do, the ultimate duty of life? What should they hear about, chant about, and remember? And the second question was, what about persons who know they're about to die? Is there something special that such persons are to do at that, when that notice comes? And so, the second canto is where Shukadeva Goswami begins to speak. So, in this first canto, he's appeared, he's had a short exchange with Maharaj Parikshit, but his instructions have not come yet. And second canto is, you can say, where Srimad Bhagavatam begins, or where... So this is the prelude to Shukadeva Goswami speaking. It begins in the second canto. But everything that he's going to speak is, in essence, presented in canto 1. So I'm going to go now quickly to the second chapter, where, in a summary way, in the first chapter and parts of the second chapter, Shukadeva Goswami has answered the question. In short, detachment and attachment to the Supreme. For attachment to the Supreme to happen, there has to be a conception of the Supreme. So forming a conception of God in the preliminary way of seeing God within nature, and then, in chapter 2, seeing God within the heart. And literally, meditating, seeing the form of Paramatma within the heart is discussed. And then reaching the conclusion, because I want to speak about chapter 3, this is all just background. In the course of describing the process of dhyana, there's a parallel between the process of knowledge. Those who are cultivating the process of knowledge are fond of this Virat Rupa, the universal form or God within nature, because they can speculate their brains out about what that means. And they do. But that's not what Hiranyagarbha meditation is meant for. It's meant to form within the mind a conception of God as a person when that conception is absent. And then after the conception of God, the form of God. So after completing that discussion, that there is a very detailed description of the journey of the soul for the meditator, who actually becomes very accomplished in the process of meditation, and the journey of the soul in an upward direction, just as is described in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad and other Upanishads that describe the journey of the soul through the upper planetary region, through the Atri region. Here it describes in the second canto, through the above the Milky Way, into the region of the planet of the God of Fire. The soul, the yogi, enters into that planet, and his reactions to sinful deeds are burned away or cleansed. And then he continues higher through the Shishumara circle, heading for Brahmaloka. There's detail of there are three types of persons and three precincts or regions in Brahmaloka, depending upon their getting there by pious activities, by the yoga process. Those that are perfected yogis, they stay for some time but then continue through the coverings of the universe, enter the spiritual sky, and they remove the coverings of passion and ignorance and the false ego. And when the ego is dissolved, then their spiritual form is manifest, and they find themselves in the spiritual planets. Hari Bol. That's a very long journey. And if there's even any subtle desire, you get stuck. Even a little subtle desire. Prabhupada once described it in a very simple way. When the soul leaves the body, heading towards an upper region, if there is a desire, even a desire of curiosity, I wonder what it's like down there. The soul goes there, gets covered in a gross material body of that particular place, and has to hang out for a whole lifetime just to check it out, even if it's just curiosity. So to go back to Godhead is the question of Maharaj Parikshit, is what is a person to do in general? What is the duty of life? The duty of life, in simple language, is to end the cycle of birth and death. But then, well, where do you go and what do you do when you end the cycle of birth and death? If there isn't a clear God conception, you're not going to do either one, end the cycle of birth and death, or go somewhere other. There has to be a clear conception of what the other is. And that clear conception is just a beginning. Purification is required. So I'm going to go now just to the concluding verses of chapter 2. He says, Shukadeva Goswami says, in text 33, we'll just cover quickly 33 through 37, and we'll see if we even get into chapter 3. Text 33, he says, for those who are wandering in the material universe, that's all of us, there is no more auspicious means of deliverance than what is aimed at in the direct devotional service of the Lord. Now, he's outlined some indirect processes. So Prabhupada has explained, the transcendentalists are two kinds, those that proceed indirectly and those that proceed directly. So he's explaining, now I'm going to go on a side over here, and Jiva Goswami, in his Bhakti Sandarbha, you know what the Sandarbhas are? Sandarbhas. You know who Jiva Goswami is? Yes, everybody knows Jiva Goswami. Jiva Goswami wrote 100,000 verses. How long is Bhagavad Gita? How many verses? 700. How many verses in Srimad Bhagavatam? 18,000. How many verses in Mahabharata? 100,000. So it's like Jiva Goswami wrote 2 Mahabharats and about 5 or 6 Bhagavatams and 7 or 8 Bhagavad Gitas and some smaller books worth of verses. When he wrote commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam, he wrote 3 commentaries on Srimad Bhagavatam. One of them was like what Prabhupada did, all the 18,000 verses. Then he wrote another commentary that was just on the 10th canto. And then he wrote a 3rd commentary that was topics from the Srimad Bhagavatam. That's what the Sandarbhas is. It's a commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam, topic by topic, subject matter by subject matter, divided into 6 sat sandarbhas. One of those 6 sandarbhas is bhakti sandarbha. In his bhakti sandarbha, he discusses bhakti. Where in the Srimad Bhagavatam is the subject of bhakti explained, and then he breaks it down into many, many, many subdivisions. So the question of Shukadeva Goswami, of Maharaj Parikshit to Shukadeva Goswami, what is it that one should do? He gives in the Bhagavatam many recommended things that one should do, and then says, da-da-da-da, what you should really do is just devotional service. And doesn't Krishna do the same thing in Bhagavad Gita? Sarva dharmam parityaja mam ekam shananam braja aham tvam sarva papebhyo moksha yashami masuchaha. So Prabhupada says the Srimad Bhagavatam is the companion, the graduate literature. There's the undergraduate. This is the graduate literature. It's not a different message in Bhagavad Gita. It's taking the ABCs of Bhagavad Gita and explaining it more precisely and more deeply. And so, the question of Maharaj Parikshit, what is one to do? What is that subject matter that one should hear, chant, and remember? He's given step, the first step, and the second step. Now he's giving the complete step, like all the way. So we should understand that the other lesser positions are but steps. Bhagavatam is taking the message of Bhagavad Gita and explaining it more expanded manner. So there are steps, but one should understand those steps lead to a certain a goal. When we're practicing Krishna consciousness or taking a spiritual journey, we should be very keen to understand what is the goal. I'll just share a little anecdote with you. There's one disciple of Srila Prabhupada named Rupanuga, who Prabhupada respected very much and trusted very much and gave him the service, even when our movement was just in the fledgling stage, to go start a center in a university town. There was very, very few devotees, but Prabhupada had the vision to see to college preaching, and he sent Rupanuga to do it. And then later Rupanuga came back after making about 50 devotees from this one university that I went to. He came back and became the president of New York, but he kept that mood of wanting to go to visit colleges. And he's a very stately, poised personality, kind of balding, receding forehead, and sharp eyes, and penetrating gaze, just like this awesome personality. And he had this procedure. I'll just share it with you. It's, imagine being in a college in America where it's, you know, the Wild West. He would sit down, lay out a very beautiful, colorful cloth, a print like a Madras cloth from India. Then a picture, a little platform, picture of Prabhupada, and then an incense holder. He's doing all this while the class is silently watching him do everything. And he would light a stick of incense and offer it to Prabhupada, sit down, and he would sit very straight like a yogi, pull out a little tiny pair of kartals, and explain to them the Hare Krishna mantra and chant. And then he looked at the audience, and the first words that he spoke was, "What is the highest truth that you know?" That's where he started. He had everybody like sitting on the edge of their seat wondering, what's this guy going to do? And the first thing he does is ask them, "What's the highest truth that you know?" Wow. And then he would, so he went different directions depending upon how the audience respond. Many cases it was, they were just blank. But he would explain that if you don't, depending upon the response, if the understanding of God, according to the teaching of the Vedas, is that from which everything comes, janmad yasya yataha. That's the highest truth that exists. That from which everything else that exists finds its existence. That's God. Whatever that is, that's God. And the goal of life is to reach knowledge of the absolute truth. That's where he started from. And then in different directions depending upon the audience. And there are different ideas of what is truth and how to reach it. There's abundant ideas out there in the marketplace of what is truth and how to reach it. So then he would take the truths that people presented, and then he would dismantle them very expertly and gently and present a higher truth, and present the absolute truth, and present the means to reach the absolute truth, which is the reverse order of what Maharaj Parikshit is doing. He's establishing their various means of understanding God and their higher means, and there's the complete means of understanding God. He then says, text 34, "What I have just described to you, Lord Brahma, the firstborn living being who received this knowledge directly from within his heart, from the Supreme Lord himself, he then studied it 3 times and came to the same conclusions that I've just given you." It's not just my opinion. This is the statement of the Vedas. And then he says, text 35, that one can reach this same conclusion by taking help from intelligence. That is, gyan. But more than gyan. What is the verse from Bhagavad Gita after the gyani, after many, many births and deaths, comes to some position? What is that verse? Bahunam janmanam ante gyanavan mam prapadyate. What's the rest? Vasudev sarvamiti samahatma sadurlabha. So what is the meaning? The meaning is, after many, many births and deaths, the person who is following the path of knowledge may reach the end of the path. They also may not. If they do reach the end of the path, here's the evidence that they have. Two things. They find the absolute truth. Vasudev Sarvamiti. And the second thing, the proof that they've reached the end of that path and they've actually understood what is the source of everything, they surrender unto him. Jnanavam mam prapadyate. There's the evidence of knowledge. There's other things that are pointed to as the evidence of knowledge, but there is a very important one. So, Sukadeva Goswami says, by taking help from the intelligence, one can come to that position. Instead of taking many lifetimes, you can do it very quickly. Just before coming here, we discussed it took about a half an hour instead of many lifetimes. There are steps. I'm not going to go through them because it would take a half an hour. But you can. The point is, Jiva Goswami points to this in his Sandarbhas. The real intelligence is taking help from the intelligence of Supersoul. Or, say it differently. Real intelligence is to recognize the limitation of our intelligence. That intelligence says, I'm limited. I'm limited, and I'm dependent, and therefore, even in ordinary circumstances, I have to take help from superior intelligence just to do any of the daily functions that I do. To cry. to digest your food. You sit down, okay, now I've taken my food and I'm going to digest this food. It happens. To learn to walk. Because we have the power of locomotion. How do you know how to learn to walk? How does a little kitten or calf or the offspring that's come from the mother know how to nourish itself? They don't go to school and say, okay, this is what you do. You go over to the breast of the mother and you take the milk from the mother. Oh, okay. You can say it's nature, but there, behind that nature, there's an intelligence. It's a very common thing in America. It's probably not here, but the geese from Canada, they fly south as the cold weather is coming. How do they know to fly south? How do they know when to do it? And how do they know to fly in a V formation? They didn't go to bird school. They know how to, there's intelligence being supplied. So with a little, we'll do our other, besides everyone move forward, if you have one of those little gizmos, cell phone, mobile phone, press the vibrate mode or turn it off, one or the other, please. Thank you. In short, one is taking help from intelligence all the time. If one takes help from intelligence, one can understand that I'm taking help from intelligence. And that intelligence is something other than me. The source of that intelligence. There's a higher intelligence that's helping me. That's just one of seven steps. Another step is to recognize that function of giving intelligence to conduct the affairs of material nature is not the sum total of God. That's the material affairs, and they're spiritual affairs. Just like an officer in a government post, he has his private life. It's not all that he does is sit in the office and shuffle papers, say yes and no to people, and then his life ends. He has a personal life. So God also has his personal activities, along with expanding himself as the Paramatma. So by taking help from intelligence, one worships the Supreme Lord. In short, to save a half an hour's discussion. So he's indicated that the highest activity, the most recommended activity for people in general, as well as for a person about to die, is to engage in unalloyed devotional service. One needs to recognize the object of that devotion by taking help from intelligence. That's the sign of real intelligence, that one has done that. Then, 36 and 37 ends the chapter. O King, therefore, it is essential that every human being hear about, glorify, and remember the Supreme Lord always and everywhere. Now, the Sanskrit of this verse, Shrotavya Kirtitavyascha Smartavyo Bhagavan Rinam, is the same as the question asked by Maharaj Parikshit at the end of chapter 19. What is it that one should hear about, chant about, and always remember? Same Sanskrit. And the answer is, Harikatha is what one should hear about and always remember. Harikathamritam. And that's what Srimad Bhagavatam is. It's topics about Hari, topics about the personality of Godhead. And when one does that properly, then all the degrading influences of life are eliminated, which is very nice. All of the soul's contact with material energy since time immemorial meaning you can't go back in time and go back in time and go back in time and find at what point in time did it begin. Same language as Krishna describes in Bhagavad Gita, anadi. Adi means it has a beginning, and anadi means that you can't find the beginning. It's not the soul's natural position to be in contact with matter, but it's been so long, you can't find the beginning of it. When is that? When did it happen? And it's not so important to find when it can happen, when did it happen. It's important to get out of the circumstance. Like Prabhupada describes, when a person is drowning, is it so important to understand how I got in this position? Someone throws him a life raft. Take the life raft, grab hold, I'll pull you to the shore. Wait a minute, how did I get here? Never mind how you got here, grab hold of the life raft. I'm not going to grab hold of the life raft until I can understand how I got here. The mishap, the misuse of free will that brought us to this position is a baffling circumstance that in our present condition, Prabhupada very clearly explains in Bhagavad Gita in the 13th chapter, it's not something from our present situation we'll be able to understand, and it is not our mission either. Our mission is to get out of the circumstance of the soul's bondage in material existence. The Bhagavatam, in the end of the second canto, the answer to Maharaj Parikshit's question is that bondage is cut just by this hearing process. Beginning with the hearing process, and cha, the conjunction, Jiva Goswami points out, means, and all of the other favorable recommended activities in conjunction with hearing and chanting. In his Bhakti Sandarbha, he explains this hearing and chanting is essential. Hearing and chanting doesn't just mean, although it does include, the chanting of our sacred mantras. It also means hearing how to apply the purified state of consciousness in practical affairs of life, which comes from the hearing of Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita and other related literatures. In other words, both things are required: purified consciousness and proper direction in life. In simple language for our American or Western audience, Prabhupada says, explained, that a train moves on two tracks. Now they have monorails, but train moves on two tracks. One track, if it's missing, what happens to the train? It capsizes, it falls over. That you can't progress. When both tracks are there, then one can move. Similarly, in spiritual life, two things are needed: that which purifies our consciousness, that which makes the heart pure, and that which gives proper direction to our activity. Any religion has to have both things. For us, the chanting of the holy name is there. But without seeking some kind of purity, without standard knowledge, can be sentimentalism turned into fanaticism. And in this world, I think we see some fanaticism. Allah, Allah, Allah. But then if there's not just one group, there are groups of fanatics all over the place. And on the other side, if there's standard knowledge, but without purity of heart, then it's dry speculation. It doesn't take you to the goal. So both must be there, side by side. The chanting of the sacred mantras that we have, and simultaneously, very clearly and deeply considering the proper application of the resources of life. The contamination, specifically, that is explained here, the contaminated consciousness is the disposition to exploit the resources of nature. I'll read how Prabhupada explains it. The sufferings of human society are due to a polluted aim of life, namely, lording it over the material resources. And he says it again. By sufficient hearing of Srimad Bhagavatam, the polluted aim of life, namely, lording it over matter, will subside, and in general, in all parts of the world, people will be able to live a peaceful life in knowledge and bliss. So, the hearing of the topics of the Supreme Lord is the simultaneously, it's awakening, it's bringing purity and removing the contaminated, polluted aim of life, the fruitive aim of life, contact with the motive passion, says, let me exploit the resources of nature. Let me endeavor hard to get more, whether it's a godless or a godly way. I want more. Whichever works. If a godly way works, that's fine. If it's not working, while God's not looking, then a godless way. And we said that's a big, big topic. Because by and large, that's how people in general in this world are working. Godless or godly, they want material prosperity. And this implication in the degrading features of life are very much centered on this eagerness to exploit the resources of nature. I'll share a little something. One of the things that inspired me, there are several things that inspired me to come regularly to Hyderabad. You notice I've been coming regularly. One of the things, just one of many things, but one of the things was at the turn of the century, there were you know, reviews of the previous century and looking into the next century. And looking into the next century, it looked at where are places in the world that would grow enormously and become very important centers for world progress, and meaning economic progress. And one of the places that several of those studies looked at was Hyderabad. National Geographic and New York Times and, you know, all these other things. And with pictures and, you know, describing the plans for growth and so on and so on and so on. So, if one wants to influence many people in the world, then one might be concerned with places that are going to influence people in the world. But at the same time, while that economic growth is predicted to happen, and more recently, both India and China are being predicted within the next decade will be major world powers in the economic realm. Guess who is visiting in Hyderabad today? Mere coincidence, right? Let's do a little handshake here so we can prosper together in the name of whatever it is. At the same time as that prosperity comes, especially with the culture of no culture of the West, moral values, cultural values, spiritual values will disappear. They are disappearing, and through advancement of technology, they will disappear faster than you can believe it. And I just, to illustrate this with one point, some time ago I saw and sent out to some people here in India an evaluation of the eating habits of people of India. Something like 20, 25 years ago, 15% of India's population were non-vegetarian. Today's population, 50% are non-vegetarian. And of those that were still maintaining vegetarian standards, their reason was economics. And those that, the 35% that shifted, because they were more prosperous now, they were non-vegetarian. One would think, you know, it's because of religious values that they were vegetarian. If they're letting go of their vegetarian principle because of economic standards, what's happening to their religious standards? And there's a rapid growth of Christian religion and Islam religion. 2 years ago at our GBC meeting, one person from the national government called one of our GBC members and said, "I hear you're having your annual meetings, and I hope that you have really successful meetings. Because if India today continues in the direction that it's going, we will not recognize our country 10 years from now. There's only one organization in our Hindu religion that's rapidly spreading the message of our Dharma, and that's ISKCON. I hope you have very successful meetings in planning your mission." It was unprompted call. It wasn't like they were talking about something else. He called just for that reason. In short, the message is, we're being told by Shukadev Goswami, who is citing the authority of Lord Brahma, who is the original receiver of all the Vedas, this message, hearing this message, can take away all the polluted aims of life at once. And if that doesn't happen, where we're headed is not a very pretty place. If people don't have a very clear understanding of why, the why question, why do you do this? Why don't you do that? The values of India today are going to disappear. And that's going to be a great loss, not only for India, but for the world. So I hope you hear the message, and I'm trying to present it pretty strongly. Imbibing this message and speaking this message, Shrotavya Kirtitavyascha Smartavyo Bhagavan Rinam, is essential. That the preaching mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is essential. Essential. As Prabhupada has said, if a gentleman sees a blind man heading for a ditch, he has to say something. He can't just let him fall in the ditch. A gentleman can't do that. Hey, look out for the ditch! Or go and take the person gently by the arm and pull them again to the middle of the road and let them walk in the middle of the road at least. Not really going to fall in the ditch. People in this age are blind. Their vision of the spiritual vision that a Brahmana is supposed to provide society, the head of the body of society, is absent. Largely. And so the Srimad Bhagavatam is meant to give back that vision or cleanse away, because many persons have some, let's say, basic faith in God, but how to live a godly life? A lot of confusion, misunderstanding, laziness. Mandaksa mandamatayo mandabhagya yubhadruta is going on. And that was 5,000 years ago. What to speak of now? It's imperative that this message of Srimad Bhagavatam is understood by at least some percentage of society. And Prabhupada, there's a list of quotes like that long. Prabhupada said he wasn't expecting that everyone would become a devotee. And that's not necessary for bringing about a transformation or re-spiritualization of society, but some portion of society, some small percentage, Prabhupada would say, must clearly understand this, must clearly live their life according to it, and set an example for others from all classes of society, to set example for others. And to give this knowledge in the form of distributing books, in the form of conducting discussion groups, or whatever ways of getting the message into the lives, into the hands, into the hearts of people in general. When one has the symptom of one who has heard, emphasis is upon hearing, the symptom of one who has heard, he'll vibrate that message. And he'll apply the message in his life, both things. Without application, the repeating of the message is going to have limited effect. Application must be there, and then when the speaking happens, there's potency to it. So that's a background to chapter 3. Which is what I plan to speak about. So I think what I'll do is stop here, see if there's some discussion, and then we'll continue probably tomorrow morning on chapter 3. Pure devotional service, change in heart. I'll just give a little preview. The little preview is, so Shukadeva Goswami has answered his question. Now he's going to take that answer, the bhakti, devotional service, and expand on it. And to expand on it, much like he does in Bhagavad Gita, in the seventh chapter and in the ninth chapter. He says what pure devotion isn't, in order to understand, in contrast, what pure devotion is. Mixed devotion, which pure devotion isn't, says, I accept the existence of God, and I also am clinging tightly to material desire what to do. So there's steps in what to do, and the one must, at least, the Vedic culture says that one must accept a superior authority. So go to a superior authority who will take care of your wish list of your desires. So therefore there's demigod worship. But if one, after going through the demigod worship, if there's a desire to achieve this ultimate goal, then one just needs to worship the personality of Godhead. And then whatever your position is, sarvakama, moksha-kama, or akama, devotional service is the answer. So that's where we're going tomorrow morning, and perhaps tomorrow evening too. So any discussion? Questions? Yes. Parikshit Maharaj was asking about the dependents' welfare. Yes, he was.
He was asking for his citizens also, because he is a ruler. If he leaves, Kali Yuga is going to, there is no proper ruler as such.
Yeah.
So he was thinking that, here dependents means who exactly?
Well, he was the king. He relinquished the kingdom, but he's a magnanimous soul, whether a king or a sage. He's concerned. And through the appearance of Srimad Bhagavatam in this world, the protection of his citizens would be made available. And us too, so many generations later. Spiritual sound vibration has such potency. Okay? Anything else?
As in the first cant of Bhagavatam, second chapter, is exactly the same thing what you just now said.
Yeah.
So, what is the difference or a kind of a...
The message is not a different message, it's just expanding the message. You know, you can say, how many sweet preparations can you make with milk? Rasgulla, rasamala, you know, there's a long list, and they're just milk sweets. But they're so tasty. And one of the beautiful things of the Srimad Bhagavatam is looking at the same subject from a different angle, and the attraction for those topics grows by appreciation from different angles. You can understand from all different angles, so many different angles of vision, what this essence message of Srimad Bhagavatam is. For that matter, it's all within the Maha Mantra. It's just, but Krishna is unlimited. It's not repetition, it's the unlimitedness of Krishna. So by design, Vyas compiled the first canto in such a manner that the essential understandings are all packed up there in those first three chapters. But as, let's say, in the third chapter, where there's, because one of the questions is, please describe the incarnations of the Lord as he appears in this world. So it's just one verse. And then later there's many chapters. So there's a verse over there in the second chapter, and then there's many chapters expanding on that subject matter. It's not a different message. It's expanding on the same subject matter. So we have a very clear understanding, and not just understanding, the cleansing of consciousness is complete. Whatever doubts may be there, they're addressed and eradicated, leaving only one thing. Shelter at the lotus feet of Krishna. That's the first two cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam.
Maharaj, what is the recommended method to understand Bhagavatam in the correct way?
You know the answer. The recommended method is ardent hearing from the proper source, and then doing that regularly, and applying the message that you hear. You knew the answer, you were just examining if I knew the answer. Okay. Yes, in the back. Here comes the microphone.
In the whole of Bhagavatam, Sukadeva Goswami does not take the name of Radharani. May I know, like, why he does?
You know the answer also. You've not heard? Anyone that knows the question usually knows the answer also. Who is Sukadeva Goswami besides the son of Vyas? Who is Sukadeva Goswami in his spiritual identity? According to Brahma Vaivarta Purana, he's the parrot or Shuka of Radha. And were he to directly say Radha's name, he might lose it. He might become so overwhelmed in ecstasy he wouldn't be able to complete the Bhagavatam, and so he didn't speak of her by name, but spoke of her indirectly. The best of all worshippers. Aradhanam Sarvesham. You knew the answer. Any questions that somebody doesn't already know the answer to?
Maharaj, you were describing that with, you know, the progress and materialistic progress in a city like Hyderabad, qualities are fading. Qualities are fading, and so, and now staying in such a city, we have to face the rapid degradation and involve with the, you know, degradation also. In such a situation, how do we protect ourselves from
preaching? Why did Prabhupada go to the West? Why did Prabhupada leave Vrindavan to go to New York City? Was he unaware of what a degraded situation it was? Why did he do such a thing? He was on a mission. And because he was on a mission, he was protected. When one goes into, why would a doctor go into a disease-infested place? He's a doctor. That's his work. He helps cure diseases. Before he goes, he takes an inoculation. What's our inoculation? The Sankirtan mood. If one is a salvationist or a, you know, trying to remain neutral, this isn't the place. The caves, the mountains, forests, far away as you can get. But that's not going to stop the encroachment even in those places of the advancement of Kali. But the Sankirtan movement of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is. Those very same persons can become devotees of the Lord. Just one thought is coming to mind. There was one man in India who was the leading proponent for abortion. That person, through the association with the devotees of the Bhaktivedanta Hospital, is now chanting 16 rounds and is a leading proponent against abortion. Through association with devotees. I mean, demoniac. So demoniac, it's not even spoken about in the Vedas. You shouldn't kill a child in the womb. Anyway, etc. through association. So whenever one is preaching, one should understand there's risks. But one should understand if you're not preaching, there's even greater risks. And it through association, our preaching can be much more effective. Now, one of the things that gets lost, perhaps, is standards, because there's so many persons and so many different positions of devotion. So then, when preaching, one has to be internally strong, while externally lenient, or tolerant at least, in order to bring people to Krishna consciousness. Be internally uncompromising, very strict, and externally very soft. Not just soft, or not just strict. Our protection is through preaching. And at least being in that mood. What Prabhupada writes in the Bhagavad Gita is the best way to fix the mind is to always be considering within one's mind how to establish Krishna consciousness in this world. Compassion. How to, you know, the alternative to lording it over material resources is to consider how the resources can be utilized in service to Krishna. When Prabhupada went for walks in New York City, he would see many different buildings and just consider, oh, that would be a wonderful temple for Krishna. Oh, that would be another wonderful temple for Krishna. So many people, how can they be engaged in service to Krishna? He saw the stark passion and ignorance. How can these people so influenced be engaged in service to Krishna? It's protection. Anything else? Yes.
Maharaj, can you please explain the message that you have just said, being internally very strict and being externally very soft?
Explain it?
Can you please give a little detail?
By soft, I mean at least, in Krishna's words, titikshava, you tolerate. You don't get on people's cases all the time. Like, you know, you learn the philosophy of Krishna consciousness and then you use it as a stick and you go bashing people. You nonsense. Pow, 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 pow. Just turn people away. And probably make offenses while doing it. So, while recognizing that others are due to not having proper guidance, not having proper association, not having a means of uplifting themselves, they become victims of this very harsh and cruel age of Kali. But Prabhupada said, people in general, they're innocent. They're being misled by people who would exploit them for whatever they can exploit them for. And they're angry because they're feeling exploited and chasing after objects that they don't need because commercialism and marketing and advertising says you got to have these things in order to have status or to be happy on all kinds of things that people don't need. And so they're misguided. And so to see that's the reality. So these bad behaviors of these other people, they're victims. Now, what can be done? It's, you know, compassion. Look upon the situation with those kinds of eyes and consider what can be done. Soft means compassion. Not like you don't have any sense of standards and anything goes and everything's okay and I'm okay, you're okay. But compassion. But internally, you know, one should be very concerned about strictness, about not going across that bridge to the other side of nescience. even a little step on that bridge, because a little step leads to the next one, leads to the next one, and it's a mess real fast. But I want to go the other direction. I want to go towards Krishna direction. I want purity in my heart. At the same time, that the real symptom of purity is there's compassion for others. Then one has to have the proper discretion in giving mercy or giving compassionate association to others, how to stay free from contamination oneself or becoming compromised in one's own standards and, you know, purity. Now, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur went so far as to say to his sannyas disciples, when you go to England, if necessary, you can eat meat. Not with, that's what he was indicating they should do, but that's the, you know, he authorized them to go to such an extent. Now, Prabhupada never went to such an extent, never authorized us to do so. But the external, how we conduct ourselves within society may seem like a worldly person. I see at the workplace. If you're just always, you know, strident and holier than thou position in the workplace, people are going to be repelled. You're not going to be able to offer any advice that people are going to take with any thoughtful, reasonable person. Well, so if you just hold yourself apart from them, so how do you mix with those people that don't have the values that you have? Don't condescend or look down upon them. Think in a mood of compassion. What can I do to help these? Even if you don't do anything, if you're thinking that way, Supersoul A will protect you, and B will give you an opportunity to do something. He'll give you the occasion will be arranged, and the intelligence what to do will be arranged. Soft, in that sense. Not compromised in principle, but soft-hearted. If one is seeking such opportunities, Supersoul will arrange opportunities. Somewhere, somehow, in the course of the unfolding of life. And even one can think properly that just by carrying this purity, that is in itself is some kind of preaching. Others will get some benefit, even just that there's some purity within. Because it comes out. You may conceal it. It still comes out. And it should be done with pride. It should be done with humility. But because that, what is purity? It's something that's given to us. It's not something, you know, because we're mighty and powerful and wonderful. So if that humility and purity is there, that's very attractive to souls who are suffering, being beaten up by the material energy. That provides opportunity to liaise with others, to connect with others. Yes? In the back?
Hare Krishna, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
Maharaj, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu predicate that coming 10,000 years, this Harinam Sankirtan movement will be there. What happens later on? Should we understand the devotees of the Lord will be not there?
We can understand that rapid degradation will take place. Now there's degradation taking place, but there's a dispensation. That is, those that take shelter of this Harinam Sankirtan movement are lifted up above that degradation. All around us, degradation is taking place. But those that take shelter are uplifted. And it's to a certain degree holding back the degradation influence. When that special dispensation era is over, it's nothing but degradation. Rampant. It's very scary. Don't be around when that happens. Take your one-way ticket while you got the chance. and take as many people on board as you can. On the ladies' side, anything?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. We can do chanting, we can read scriptures, but without unflinching faith in bona fide spiritual master, that internalization does not take place. How to feel urgency that, how to feel urgency of getting that unflinching faith in bona fide spiritual master?
Well, there's many ways. Best way is to associate with those that have that unflinching faith in a bona fide spiritual master. Another is to read the words of those who have unflinching faith in the bona fide spiritual master, as Srila Prabhupada had in Bhaktisiddhanta. You can read Lilamrita and see the unfolding of the unflinching faith that Prabhupada had, enough that it makes tears come to your eyes, to see how much faith he had and what he had to endure in order to carry out the order of his spiritual master. The sacrifices that were that he made to rescue so many people based upon that one thing, implicit faith. It's very compelling. Listen to the interviews of those that had their hearts moved by even brief association with Prabhupada, and what faith in him they had, and how that totally changed their life. So it's seeing what that faith can do, reading about it, experiencing it directly, and hearing from others. If a little drop of that can enter one's heart, it's very powerful. And that little drop should be very carefully nurtured. And just conclude by saying, if there is such a desire, as your question indicates, Krishna will see that desire and he will reciprocate beyond expectation, beyond imagination. It's for real, that it's so powerful. Having such faith is so powerful. I mean, experiencing connection with Krishna is the most powerful thing. And that's not going to happen other than through this connection of those representing him. When that connection is felt, it's not like anything else. So pray for a little drop of that. Okay, I think we'll end. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.